Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, former Marvel lawyer and current big law media attorney, Paul Sarker.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani. It's been a minute since I've been on the pod, but nice to be back, Paul.
Welcome back, Mesh. Good to have you back. Feels like almost a month. Hope you enjoyed your trip overseas and welcome back.
Yeah, it was a good trip. Nice to be back. Seems like there's a lot of stuff happening, I think, to kick it off. There's actually stuff to watch.
There's a lot of stuff to watch.
Between sports, there's March Madness. There's the new X-Men series. There's The Gentlemen by Guy Ritchie on Netflix. There's Dune 2. It's been a nice content time recently.
Jessica's film Musica comes out April 4th.
Amazing.
On Prime Video.
Amazing. Jess did the stage design and costume design?
Yeah, she was on the art team. And really, she glossed over her role when she was on this show a few weeks ago. But from my vantage point, she started out as an assistant, but by the end, she was kind of doing it all.
That's awesome.
Because it was like a war of attrition on that film. It's a beautiful film. Looking forward to it. April 4th. Spring is here. We're turning the page on winter. It's spring. Although it is a cold and rainy weekend on the East Coast.
At least you don't need like thick jackets anymore. You can wear layers and, you know, the temperature seems to go up at the end of the day.
I didn't even take out my thick stuff this entire year, but that maybe it's just climate change. So spring is here, and that means a couple things. But for one, it's music festival season is starting. And in Miami, Ultra Music Fest is happening as we record. And I mentioned this because we were in Miami earlier this week. We weren't able to stay for the festival, which was a huge bummer because Ultra is one of my favorites. And, you know, I'm a dance music fan. That's my genre of choice.
A lot of shufflers.
Towards the back, yeah. Towards the back of the crowd, there's room to sort of shuffle. But in the center, you're basically kind of like jumping up and down, maybe side to side. Maybe you're just moving your arms up and down because it gets pretty packed. But in the back, sure, you can shuffle. People have like all kinds of intricate outfits. And it's a very plur. I don't know if they're still using that word, but it's a plur vibe. Peace, love, unity, and respect.
And I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so if you go there, it's all about the plur. And the reason I like Ultra, which I used to go to, the kicking off of spring, it's in a great venue in downtown Miami, Bayfront Park. I always think it's got, you know, one of the best lineups of any dance music festival. And the thing about it is it's sort of the first festival of the year. And all the DJs that have been working on their craft and developing new songs over the winter, they all debut a lot of unreleased songs at Ultra. So I've always found, and this is when I used to go to a bunch of festivals yearly, you kind of hear the same stuff when you're going to a festival like every couple weeks or a couple times, you know, throughout the year, you go to a bunch of festivals, you start hearing the same song over and over. But at Ultra, that doesn't really happen because there's a lot of unreleased stuff. If 11 hours of dancing during the day isn't enough for you, you still have South Beach where all the clubs and stuff are open at night. So I can't do that anymore, but congrats to anyone that's there and enjoy it. Another thing that I think of when I think of spring is baseball. Our first story actually potentially be really sad. The best baseball player in the world, Shohei Ohtani, he's a phenom from Japan. If you don't know who he is, he came up in the Japanese baseball league, started out with the Nippon Ham Fighters, and he's just one of the best pitchers and one of the best hitters, which is something that hasn't been done in probably since the era of, like, I don't know, the 1930s, like Babe Ruth. He is literally, you know, an all-star, potentially Cy Young caliber pitcher, and he's also a threat as a hitter, which just hasn't been seen in anyone's lifetime, or maybe some people.
So wait,
alive,
I'm not really following baseball that much, but he's like the guy. Is he like one of the best players in the whole league?
He is one of the best players in the world. He is the best player in the world. So
wow, okay.
He came over to the States in 2018, and he's played with the LA Angels for six seasons. He won two MVPs and one Rookie of the Year. But his team has never won anything. He's never even made the postseason. And he's been a little injury prone. He's had arm injuries twice because pitching is just very destructive on your on the ligaments in your elbow. And he also hits. So he plays a style that's a little bit aggressive and he's kind of injury prone, but he's just a phenomenal player when he's healthy. And he just signed with the Dodgers a 10-year, $700 million agreement.
That sounds massive. Is that one of the biggest contracts?
It's the biggest baseball contract ever. It's probably the biggest sports contract ever.
Really?
Yeah. So, well, in the U.S. professional
In the U.S. sport. Is baseball the biggest sport in the country?
No, but it generates a lot of revenue from the TV. And this is changing, but like basically baseball players have the biggest contracts. Because they go long, they can have sign like 10, 12, 13-year contracts. So the average annual value might be slightly lower than what like a quarterback might make in the NFL. But because they have 10, 12, 13-year deals, the numbers get astronomical. Wow. The NBA is approaching that. You have players that are getting $300 million deals, but no one's at the $700 million
That's
level.
That's a lot of money. Holy crap.
The thing with Ohtani's contract is he's... $680 million of it is deferred. So he did this really favorable deal for the Dodgers where most of his money will be paid when he's done playing. They can field a really competitive team around him now.
So I read that and I thought that was interesting. One, from a standpoint of this guy probably doesn't need the money right now. And two, that's a pretty selfless thing to do. And I'll say this as, I wonder if that's more of a coming from Japan and having a bit more of a community-centric approach versus like the individual, which you see in a lot of like sports in general, right? It's always about the player versus the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a couple things. For baseball, there is a luxury tax, so it's like a soft salary cap. So if your team spends over a certain threshold, they have to pay a dollar-for-dollar penalty. So when you have a huge deferral like this, only a portion of his $70 million every year counts against that tax, the salary.
I see. Okay.
And so that helps the team spend more and avoid the luxury tax that would be payable if you got 100% in the current year. And he also has a huge endorsement business. And I think this is an open question, but I think, and we can do a separate episode about this, he might be trying to take the position that he doesn't owe California state tax on all of it because he might move.
I was about to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, look, I love how I'm like, I wonder if there's a community. It's more like there are probably really good financial and tax reasons to be doing something like this as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's mainly to help the Dodgers avoid the luxury tax, but also he doesn't, I mean, how much money can you possibly spend? Well, that's the story here, right? So the reason we're talking about it now is because we're on the eve of baseball season. Baseball starts this week. And there's this controversy because his longtime interpreter,
this guy he's known for
11 years, was just fired by the Dodgers last week for apparently stealing from him. And the story, it depends who you ask and when you came across it because Shohei's camp has changed their tune over the course of this. And like I said, this is all allegations. We're just reporting what's been publicly stated in the news. We have no inside information. We're not taking a position one way or another. But the play-by-play is that apparently Shohei's interpreter has a really bad gambling habit. He's been gambling since I don't know how long, but gambling is very popular in Japan. You know, pachinko is like one of the most, you know, common pastimes. So I assume he got to the U.S. and he's like, oh, well, gambling's legal in a lot of states. You can gamble on your phone. Maybe it was like, you know, there's casinos all over Southern California and like Indian tribal lands and stuff. So he went ham. For lack of a better term, he was spending a lot of money. He met a bookie at a poker game in 2021. And I guess he just would. So he knew probably that that was illegal gambling at that point.
But he's not a player. So it doesn't matter whether he gambles, right? Like there's nothing on the, I wonder if there's any rules for the interpreter. I know the players can't gamble on baseball, but they can gamble on other sports. But the interpreter, like, could he be gambling on their own games?
Well, that's the gray area. So technically, you know, I think you just have to comply with, you know, applicable federal and state law. And so certain gambling is illegal. Sports gambling has been legalized by the Supreme Court. And so it depends on your state whether you can do it or not. But as you said, the MLB can apply stricter rules against its players and say, okay, well, it might be legal, but we don't want players gambling on baseball or anything because we think it just it harms the sanctity of the game. So it's a bad look. Pete Rose, one of the best baseball players ever, has been banned for life from baseball and from the Hall of Fame because he allegedly bet on baseball. And I think he's, I don't know whether he's admitted to it, but the point is gambling and baseball, if you're a baseball player, there's a really strong prohibition against it. And the reason this is important is because Shohei,
he allegedly
is the one who sent the money to the bookie. So he sent millions of dollars to this bookie. He claims he was doing it to bail out his interpreters who got into, like, who fell into a lot of debt.
Just so I understand, like, the interpreter was, like, he owed $4.5 million or something like that. And then he was like, hey, will you pay? He basically, Shohei agreed to pay his debts off, and then he wired the money from his account.
Right. So his interpreter's name is Ippe Mizuhara. And what he's saying, what Shohei initially said was, okay, I knew this guy had a gambling problem. He told me he had $4.5 million in debt. I told him I would cover that. If he agreed to pay me back, I'd loan him the amount as long as he agreed to never do it again. And that Shohei didn't trust him with the money, so he decided to pay it directly to the bookie. That's right. What he said. So he sent the money electronically.
That
to
makes
the bookie.
Sense. That makes sense why you do that.
It does make sense. And you wonder whether it was Shohei that was gambling. Like, that's the open question. It's like, how close was he to this? So that's why the next day after this story initially broke, because ESPN first broke the story, the Dodgers fired the interpreter and said that Shohei was the victim of a theft.
Right.
And so Shohei's camp, after he consulted with his lawyers and everything, they said, we had no knowledge of this. The interpreter stole $4.5 million. And that's the sort of story now, is like Shohei didn't voluntarily send the money. The interpreter stole it. And so it's a little unclear what's going on.
So Shohei released a statement recently saying that the initial version of the facts that his interpreter gave to the media last week in Korea was false, that Shohei was the victim of theft, that he never knowingly bet on sports, including baseball, and that he never knowingly or intentionally sent money to bookies, and any money that was sent from his account was a result of him being the victim of theft. Maybe his interpreter had access to his accounts. It's unclear, but Shohei saying he wasn't involved in any of this. He didn't gamble on sports and he didn't send money to any bookies. So that's Shohei's latest statement.
That's tough because that's one of those things. You got a $700 million player who's very important. You got this legal thing. You got this potential scapegoat or actual, like, hey, this person has committed a crime, and unfortunately this baseball player is involved with it. So it's
and
funny.
The reason it came up is because the bookie, Boyer, is under federal investigation. So they've raided his apartment, they've gone through all his files, and they found Shohei's name in a wire transfer. And there's a whole language barrier thing here, right? Like, he doesn't speak English, so who really knows what he knew or what was communicated? I'm sure the Dodgers, the MLB wants this thing to just go away and, like,
oh my
they don't
God.
Want people talking about it. But it's a major story involving, I can't think of a time, it's happened in the NFL, but not with, like, the best player in the game, where some players, they get suspended for betting on football. Some players have been suspended. Calvin Ridley got suspended for an entire season for violating. The players always say it's ironic because you can't watch a game without seeing, like, a dozen sportsbook ads. So for the leagues and the teams to make so much money advertising this, and then to come down on the players, it's somewhat hypocritical. At least some of the players are saying that. But you've never had the best player in a sport embroiled in some gambling controversy while they're an active player. I can't think of that happening. So this is going to be crazy. And I'm sure people hope it just gets forgotten. But there's a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how the story unfolds.
Right. I think it was over time. I think they were, like, in $500,000 installments, but still, it's a big chunk.
Yeah, interesting. Nice breakdown. We'll keep the story updated for folks. So let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about a UFC lawsuit that just got settled.
So, Mesh, the UFC, I know you're a fan of UFC. It's too violent for me, but I appreciate that it is, like, one of the fastest growing sports in America. People really get into it. Our guest last week, Rishika Jakaria, was thinking about getting into maybe female MMA.
Oh yeah,
if dancing yeah. doesn't work out, or you know, it's as a hobby. And so this we'll do the legal background in a second, but just to give people the overview, UFC has grown immensely in value over the past decade and a half, and it really is, you know, it's now owned by TKO, which is a merger of WWE and UFC, and Endeavor bought UFC, but it was previously owned by Zaffa LLC. And it didn't come out of nowhere, but it's grown super quickly into a, you know, $1 billion sport.
It's had a really interesting evolution because it was like the two brothers from Vegas who brought on Dana White. They bought it when it was like that crazy stuff.
$10 million or something.
Yeah.
Right?
It was like no money. It was when it was seen as like literally blood sport on TV. They bought it. They made it into a real business. They signed deals with ESPN and Reebok. And then there was the Endeavor investment. And then there was the merger. It's just grown like as a business. And now, obviously, it's part of a public company.
Right. And so TKO Entertainment and TKO Holdings, they released an SEC statement. They filed a statement saying that they paid this settlement, $335 million, to settle a lawsuit that was filed initially. The first lawsuit was filed in 2014.
Yeah.
Subsequently, new plaintiffs have joined. It was certified as a class. There were 1,200 fighters alleging violations of antitrust law. So basically, what they're saying, what the fighters are saying, is that UFC engaged in anti-competitive, somewhat monopolistic behavior to pay them below market wages. So what they did was some combination of making players sign long-term exclusive agreements to prevent them from hitting free agency, coercing them into signing agreements by withholding or penalizing them if they didn't, and also engaging in anti-competitive behavior to harm the market for competitive MMA promoters. So they would either buy competitors and shut them down or knock them out of business to just make sure that they controlled the market.
Yeah, and just to give people like a... During that time, and I've been watching the UFC for a while, but the time that they're talking about, like the UFC was, you know, it was costing a lot of money for them to run this thing. They were trying to make it a legitimate business. You have all sorts of other promotions that are out there, like Pride, you had Strikeforce, where you're competing with all the attention of these fighters who could, you know, if they, I'm not saying they should have done what they did. I'm saying to survive as a business, it would have been just fighters jumping from promotion to promotion to promotion for the most money. And this is something that you see in boxing a lot, where it's the promoters, you know, each fight is a different promoter. Here, the UFC wanted to make more of like an NBA. And to do so, they had to essentially like keep the fighters from leaving. But also, I think it was how much could they afford to do this?
Right. But the difference there is the NBA and the NFL and the MLB and hockey, they all have collective bargaining agreements where the players have a union where they're able to negotiate with the owners over the terms that apply for like 3 years, whatever. So it's not like in this case, the UFC fighters are saying they never had the opportunity to collectively bargain.
No.
It was just like, hey, this is the deal. You got to take it. And I think that's why there was some teeth to these claims. And so in January, UFC lost a motion to dismiss. They filed a motion to dismiss. The judge denied it. And so they were looking at going into trial in a few weeks, and that's why they settled, because the potential damages would have been between $1 and $2 billion. So they just settled for $335 million.
And look, I'm glad. I've always, you know, fighters been talking about fighters' pay and the increase in fighters. They're still talking about it right now. It's tough when it's not a team sport. It's an individual sport. So the outliers like your Conor McGregor, who, by the way, was just in that new Roadhouse remake, which I did see, which, you know, it was okay. He's pretty funny in it. But I would say that the Conors of the world have the most leverage to, like, get paid a lot of money. They don't need to necessarily fight because they have so much money coming from outside. And the fighters almost need a Conor to be on their side to create, like, you know, a fair fighters agreement or a union. But then you have like a Conor who's like, it's pretty individual. It's hard for him to be like, well, I'm making so much money, I don't really care about everyone else. And so you can see the frustrations that they have, because a lot of times they, like a Nate Diaz, for people who know, fight Conor McGregor, like, doesn't really want to fight in the UFC. He wants his contract to run out because he's just not able to make as much money. The contract runs out. Usually what happens is they go do like a few boxing stuff with YouTubers. That's why you see a lot of these boxing fights, so they can make a lot more money, because in the UFC, it's just not as much that they can make. And it's more now, but what it than it used to be. It was really tough for them in the beginning.
Right. And so as we said when we were talking about like the SAG and WGA strikes, the unions don't necessarily exist to help the stars. They exist to help the people at the bottom,
yeah,
and to establish minimums for people who are trying to make it in, people at the start of their career. And if you're an A-list actor or an A-list writer, you're going to make enough. But
yeah,
it's everyone else that needs the benefit of the collective bargaining. In this case, you know, when they're agreeing to a settlement, a lot of times in settlements, you don't actually have to admit that you did anything wrong, and you don't have to admit that you're going to do anything different going forward. You just kind of pay,
right,
the people who are suing you for them to settle their claims. So they're not, the 1,200 people that are suing aren't going to get anything else. But it doesn't necessarily mean, and I think the industry will probably have to mature and fighters will get paid more, but it's not like UFC is undertaking wholesale changes as a result of this.
No. And this was, okay, so there's a good example of this with the Reebok deal. When the UFC, this is the Reebok deal, now it's Venom, I believe. But when the UFC, originally you would see like every fighter was sponsored by a whole bunch, their shorts had all different sponsors on it. That's how they made a lot of their money. And then they signed a deal with Reebok, and Reebok essentially said, no more, no one else can be on the shorts. It's just us besides Monster, I think. And the pay went significantly lower for a lot of folks. It was like not great pay at all. And if you weren't a star, you were barely getting paid at all. And I remember people being really upset about that, because they're like, dude, one of the biggest ways we make money is like through random sponsors, and you can't do that anymore.
Endorsements, yeah. Yeah, so maybe the UFC does end up doing some sort of collective bargaining agreement with its fighters, but I just think to get in and out, it's so competitive that maybe it doesn't happen. I'm not 100% sure. But the whole foundation of antitrust law, just to give a little bit of context, so we've talked about this before, it's called competition law internationally, antitrust law in the U.S. If you believe, starting from the baseline premise, that competition is good for the economy and that free markets result in the best allocation of resources for, you know, an economy or for a group of people, that's the philosophy behind antitrust law, which basically in the US started with the Sherman Antitrust Act. And it says a couple things, but really it comes down to two concepts. One, any restraint on trade is illegal. And two, the effects of having a monopoly or being able to restrict supply and increase prices, that's bad for consumers. So there's two sections of the Antitrust Act, and it's been interpreted. So obviously, any contract is a restraint of trade. They're not all illegal. What it's been interpreted as is unreasonable restraints of trade. Things like price fixing, cartels can be illegal. We haven't talked about NIL in a while, but you know, NCAA basically has a market power over the college athletics market. They've been able to prevent players from earning wages. And they're on very thin antitrust ground, which is why they're allowing all the NIL stuff to happen. And then there's another aspect of it, which is monopoly behavior, which if you have a monopoly and you control, let's say, 70% of the market, you can restrict supply and increase the price without competitors coming in and making you lower your price or stealing profits away. And if you have a monopoly that you got just through innovation or having a better product, that's fine. That's not illegal. But if you have a monopoly through anti-competitive behavior, like buying your competitors down. or doing other things, then you're running the risk of violating antitrust law. And so companies get sued under antitrust grounds all the time, because in the US there's a private right of action, but antitrust cases are very long. They're very time consuming. And so I could see why in this case, the plaintiffs were like, okay, do we want to go? It's already been 10 years since we filed the complaint. Do we want to sit through another couple years of this and however many millions in legal fees, or do we just want to take, you know, a guaranteed $335 right now?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I find it funny that it's the UFC that's part of TKO and the other companies, the WWE, and you saw similar stuff happen with the WWE's rise at the time, right? The WWE at the time was just buying promotions left and right. And of course, the only time it had a real competitor was the WCW, and you had these wrestlers jumping from one to the other, and then it eventually bought the WCW. And it's just funny. Like, look, part of it is you got to appreciate the UFC and the WWE in terms of creating this really incredible organization that's really entertaining to fans and a position where people can go and like be great names. But then the other side, on the business side, like, what does it take to do all that? And it's not a great situation for some people.
Well, one of the tricky things with antitrust is how you define the market, right? So if I were WWE's lawyer, I wouldn't limit it to wrestling. I would say we compete with football, we compete with boxing,
right,
we compete
right.
with all these
it's
other
entertainment,
things.
Yeah,
to sure. say the market's so big that we don't really have power. But of course, if you're on the plaintiff side, you want to define it as narrowly as possible and say, well, your only competitor is WCW. So it's like, you know, is the market, you know, soft drinks or is it all beverages? Is the market streaming or is it sports streaming services? So depending on how you define the market, that's what you're going to have to convince a judge, because most antitrust cases are decided under a rule of reason analysis. And that's where these things get really murky, is like the defendant wants to define the market as broadly as possible and the plaintiff wants to define it narrowly. And I could see why, you know, if you can take a guaranteed settlement payment instead of, you know, obviously this is one of the times right 2 weeks before trial starts where the plaintiffs have as much leverage as they're going to have.
Well, good for the people who won the money. I mean, it's a chunk of change. I mean, that's no $335 million. It's a chunk. But if you think about it, it's just like payments that collectively over the course of the last decade to multiple people, you know, just paid out in one go. So
okay, so it's like $280K per person.
That's actually pretty, I'd say that's pretty legit.
No, I mean, they were asking for, I guess, up to $1.2 million per person, and they're getting $280K. So yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, in terms of what they wanted, a big discount, but I thought it was going to be like a few thousand bucks. And then it was, I didn't realize I wonder if it's equally given.
I don't know if it is. I'm just doing the math. I don't know how it's divided. I assume it's probably not pro rata, but it could be. I mean, it is a class action. Some may get more than others, but on average, it's going to be 280 per plaintiff.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, good analysis on that one. Let's take a quick break and we'll get back and talk about the Reddit IPO. Paul, so 19 years in the making, Reddit social media network has gone public after 19 years since inception, started by Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, back where they were part of the first batch of YC, Y Combinator. You know, they originally sold it to Condé Nast for, I think, $10 million. And then Sam Altman was part of like buying that company back and restructuring it and raising money, where Condé Nast still owned a piece of it. And they've grown it into, you know, a multi-billion-dollar company. It IPO'd at the price of $34 per share, which valued it at around like $6.5 billion. They were looking at getting a $10 billion valuation. Obviously, IPO markets are tough right now. But it did pop on opening, 50%. It did close on its first day at $10 billion. Honestly, that doesn't really matter because it really depends on where it goes over the next course of the year. But still, that's pretty impressive. It's pretty great, I think. It's cool to see a company like this that you've been, you know, we've seen over the two decades go public.
Yeah, agreed. And we actually talked about this in episode 304. So they had announced plans to IPO in 2021, but then they shelved them, as you said, due to challenging market conditions. Then a couple months ago, they announced that they were looking at this again, targeting early spring, late winter. And then, you know, it went public last week. As you said, market value of $6.4 billion at the IPO price, but within one trading day, it was up to $10 billion because shares went up almost like 50%.
Yeah, that's right.
And as you said, that's not an uncommon thing. A lot of times IPOs, they're priced within a range, but you want to pop usually.
Yeah,
so
you want to pop.
The initial investors like to be able to say, our stock went up so much after the IPO. It almost always happens, but then, as you said, sometimes they come crashing down to earth within a couple months or a year, and then they're down.
Sometimes below the IPO. I mean, a lot of times below the IPO price. And I think in this case, so they Reddit raised $700. There's part of it where I think a few people in the IPO, obviously there's people who hold private shares that unload it to new investors, but then there's a bunch of folks that are staying in the company in terms of like having their shares, because Reddit raised money in this IPO. They raised $740 million for the use of the company to essentially grow their advertising business, grow essentially what might be their data licensing business that we could talk about more. And so there's a lot of potential here. The advertising business is the core business. Last year they did about $800 million. But here's the thing, you know, like, It has a core advertising business. A lot of people say that the upside with Reddit is if they can figure out the advertising business. Now, other people will say that it's just really hard to advertise on Reddit. And the reason being is because Redditors just don't really care about ads. And it's hard to put ads in this like forum type conversation on the platform. So that's one thing where it's like, can they actually invest in a better advertising business? And then the second thing I'll say is that data licensing is really interesting, because this is something that's relatively, I'd say, new over the course of the last year, where your big AI companies like your OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, Apple, et cetera, are buying up training data or licensing training data. And in one case, Reddit would be considered.
Well, yeah, they were using it. Now they're licensing it.
Now they're licensing.
They're like, oh, well, we could get sued. Maybe we should just do a license.
Exactly. And so like licensing data was like, is it $20 million a year? Is it, you know, this much? In this case, what Reddit has said is that it's around $66.4 million right now in data licensing. Now,
well, they just signed a big deal with Google, right? For $60
million. Yeah, exactly. And so do those numbers go up as more data is needed? Like, this is where it's a bit unclear. Someone else would argue, well, what Reddit should actually be investing in is just creating their own, like using the data and like building their own LLM and creating their own version of like, how do we use AI to answer questions, and then like selling that as a service. And that's a much bigger business. So there's a bunch of different things that could happen here, but it's pretty unclear right now.
It is. And so, as you said, they raised $750 million. I think the company is keeping $520 million of that. The rest is people cashing out,
yeah,
like other investors that have been holding Reddit equity pre-IPO. Maybe, like you said, for 20 years, they're now, this is their payday. They can go do whatever they want with that, to the extent they sold shares and now they have cash. They can do whatever. I thought it was interesting that Reddit did keep a pool of about 1.75 million shares for the top Redditors and moderators to buy into, so that they could get in at the IPO price. That sort of rewards people who really care a lot about the platform and who keep the platform what it is. And just one more statistic. They made $800 million in revenue in 2023. Their costs were probably closer to $900. So it was a $90 million loss, which was actually smaller than the year before by a significant margin. So they're not yet profitable, but they're inching towards break even. 73 million daily active users. But when you talk about, is this a good deal? How do you value the stock? I mean, $34 at $800 million in revenue is basically like an 8-to-1 per price, or price to sales ratio. So you can't really say price to earnings because they're not profitable, but price to sales, which is in line with other social media companies. It's not as good as Snap. It's not as good as Google. It's better than Meta. And like, how do you know? Maybe it becomes a meme stock. Maybe the stock goes up to 500.
Well, that's the other thing. It could totally be a meme stock, but you know what you said about even giving access to Redditors. Like, I did like that. I thought that was pretty cool. And the reason why that's cool is that, actually, it was funny because I read an article of someone was saying like, well, why are they making us pay? That's not really giving us back. I mean, now that was one person saying that. And I think the thing to think about is that to get in at an IPO price is usually going to like a Goldman Sachs. It's going to like their top list of folks, and that's who they're selling the IPO price to, because those who buy it at the IPO is buying it at a pop. So you got it at a 50% discount from where the stock
typically
closed.
Retail investors can't get
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought that was just a cool thing to do based on your participation. It's something that I'd love to see more going forward. Like, top power users should get access. And granted, it was really small, but it's a cool message. I'm really interested to see how the data licensing play goes here. And I do wonder also from like, I think a lot of like AI potential, like advertising, can they use that to make matching better? I don't know. It's all very unclear. It's really like, do they invest this money properly into the company? I think that's what it comes down to. Because I'm sure there's probably a big look, like there's probably a lot of costs they could still probably get rid of, right? It's kind of insane how much money it costs to run this company.
Well, there's the business perspective that you're talking about, which is, hey, can they increase revenue? Can they cut the cost? Can they become profitable? Can they come up with a product that's a game changer? But then there's the other thing, which is becoming a public company and having to answer to shareholders in a different way and having to disclose a lot more information on all that scrutiny and the pressure to lure advertisers and engage in more content moderation. Is it going to cause Reddit to destroy what made Reddit appealing to 70 million people?
Totally.
That's what we don't know.
Totally. Yeah. And I would say that from a business perspective, it's good to be a public company because it forces you to look at those things to run a better business. But our Redditors, because Redditors before they went public were already at odds with management. Like, it's like Redditors never really liked the way the management was running the company. Does this make it worse? And does this, like, God knows what? I mean, that's what I kind of, you kind of appreciate the personalities of these people on the platform because they really do make it amazing. And are they going to push back? It's going to be pretty fascinating to watch. But I think it was one of those companies that was really important for a lot of folks because it shows it was the first social media company since Pinterest that went public. I think Pinterest went public, I think it was 2019. And then again, it was just a big deal. Like the fact that these guys sold this company to Condé Nast for $10 million, like not so far after they started the company. And then Condé Nast, from what I read something, so I don't know if this is true or not, made essentially $2 billion from the IPO.
$2 billion, yeah.
Which Condé Nast made probably more money from this IPO than anything else that they do because, you know, magazines are a tough world right now. So
yeah, no, great, good for them. I mean, it shows that they invested maybe wisely or fortunately or whatever, but it remains to be seen. Like I said, we did an AMA on Reddit and we're big fans of the platform. We hope they can thread the needle between making the jump to profitability while also staying true to their core. And I look forward to seeing what they do.
Yeah, great. Well, that's our show for this week, folks. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, Apple, Spotify, wherever you choose to listen. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, at Better Call Paul, the podcast. Follow me on X, at Mesh Lakhani, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders. Have a great week.